Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Amen. Today we recognize and celebrate the birth of Martin Luther King Jr., a man upon whose shoulders I stand, a man who initiated a veritable revolution in this country, a nonviolent revolution. In recognition of the birth of Martin King, I am going to share with you a letter that I wrote to him. Dr. King was well known as a great orator, but he also had a practice of writing profound, open letters. When questioned about the wisdom and appropriateness of writing open letters, King simply responded that he was following in the tradition of the Apostle Paul. The most profound of these open letters, I think, was his letter from a Birmingham jail. The open letter was written to 8 Birmingham clergy who criticized King's Birmingham campaign to end injustice and racism in that Alabama city. The basic message of the clergymen was twofold. First, they considered King to be an outsider and admonished him to go home. Secondly, they thought the timing was not right, and they admonished the black citizens of Birmingham to postpone their fight for freedom, to wait. Here's the letter that I wrote to the man that I love, respect, and admire. Dear Reverend King, I never had the privilege of meeting you, and yet I feel as though I know you. I feel that way in part because I have read at least once all the materials that I could get my hands on that you wrote. As a volunteer member of the communication staff of the Chicago branch of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, I had access to volumes of recordings, press releases, letters, and photographs, which I enthusiastically consumed. I have read multiple biographic documents, seen movies and other documentaries on you and the movement. But most importantly, I had the privilege of being in the background on Saturday mornings in a meeting room at Gladys's restaurant on the south side of Chicago. Every Saturday morning, there would be a community meeting of SCLC's Operation Breadbasket. Those Saturday morning community meetings, which were held at various churches and attended by thousands. After the community meetings, the leadership would go to Gladys's to have breakfast, strategize, and reminisce. As National Director of Breadbasket, Jesse Jackson was always there. He would be joined by his staff and whatever national SCLC staff were in town, as well as other black leaders or celebrities that were in town. An appearance at the Saturday morning community meetings of Operation Breadbasket was pretty much obligatory for any black leader or celebrity that was visiting Chicago. Jesse would host the visiting dignitaries at Gladys's after the community meeting. At one time or another, all your lieutenants were at these breakfasts, and on some Saturdays, there would be several. I would attend these breakfast meetings in my capacity on the communication staff. Typically, I functioned as the SCLC photographer. But after I had taken the appropriate pictures, I would not leave the room. I would merge into the background. I would try my best to disappear. I would typically sit on the floor against the wall. Dr. King, I had the privilege of being a fly on the wall and listen to these great men and women talk about their experiences in the movement and talk about their experiences with you. They discussed their fears and their joys, their accomplishments and their failures. It is in that restaurant that I learned the most about you and developed the love and respect for you, both as a leader and as a person. One of the things I learned about you was your great love for this country, your respect for the institutions of this country, and your faith in the goodness of its citizens. Contrary to what was said by some, you did not pose a threat to the security of the United States and you were not a communist. Quite to the contrary, you challenged Americans to be true to their stated ideals and to their Constitution. So great was your faith in America's white citizens that you thought if you held a mirror to their face, change would be inevitable. If white Americans across the country became aware of its black citizens' plight in the South, change would be demanded by those white people. It was not your goal to destroy this country. It was your goal to force it to be true to itself. You were a true patriot, contrary to the lies propagated by many, including the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Sitting on the floor of that room, I learned that Jesus was at the heart of the movement, that in your darkest hours, it was Jesus that you turned to. For your accomplishments, it was Jesus that you thanked, that Jesus was called upon to guide every meeting, every gathering, every march, every demonstration. You took seriously your obligation to be the hands and the feet and the mouth of Jesus. You took seriously Jesus' greatest commandment, to love. The common belief seems to be that your practice of nonviolence and love grew out of your Christian belief. That would make sense, but I learned that wasn't really the case. Your embracing of nonviolence and later fully embracing radical love came as a result of your experience in the movement. At first, nonviolence was simply a tactic. It was not a moral imperative. It was the only form of protest and resistance that was viable for blacks in the Deep South in the 50s. Nonviolence was exclusively a tactic. Indeed, you owned guns and you were ready to use them. In fact, the running joke in those early days amongst your closest friends was that you had a mini arsenal in your house. However, as you practiced nonviolent resistance, you internalized its true meaning, which led you to be more complete, led you to more completely understand and embrace Jesus' commandment regarding love and forgiveness. You didn't learn and embrace the true meaning of Jesus' commandments to love in Sunday school or in seminary. You grasped and internalized the true meaning of Jesus' commandments in the streets and in the jails. You witnessed the transformation of racist people and a racist nation as a consequence of radical love. The proof of the pie was in the eating for you. I think you are one of the greatest theologians that ever lived. It is one thing to sit behind the ivy-covered walls of Harvard or Yale Divinity School and postulate the true meaning of the words and the life of Jesus. It is quite another to love while you are being beat by billy clubs. The former suggests the ability to think and talk about Jesus. The latter suggests an understanding of Jesus so complete that you can act it out. The latter suggests an understanding of Jesus so clear that you can be Jesus. I thank you for giving me a true understanding of what it means to follow Jesus. I cannot hate and claim to follow Jesus. I can't practice or advocate violence and call myself a Christian. I can't turn my back on those in need and claim membership in the Jesus movement. Loving Jesus mandates my forgiving those that hurt me, and there must be no limit to my capacity to forgive. A tolerance of injustice is not consistent with the love of Jesus. Dr. King, this morning, in 2023, it is easy for us to believe that you are universally accepted. It is easy for us to think that you were honored wherever you went, but nothing could be further from the truth. You faced serious opposition wherever you went. You accepted even invited criticism from those in the white community who opposed justice for black Americans. Open opposition was essential to the success of the nonviolent movement. The open letter from Birmingham's white clergy appealing to its Negro citizens to stand down, be patient, and not demonstrate gave you the opportunity to write perhaps your greatest work. The letter from a Birmingham jail followed by the book, Why We Can't Wait. Open and virulent opposition from Bull Connor and his fire hoses and his police dogs was accepted by you. It was anticipated. It was even essential to the success of the movement. But opposition from within our community, within our race, hurt. It cut like a knife. Early on, you received opposition from the traditional black church, from Negro clergy whose interests were not served by the radicalization of Jesus, from people who proclaimed themselves as Christians and yet thought the job of a black preacher was restricted to the church building, the hospital, and the funeral home. People who proclaimed that the preacher should associate himself with the righteous, not with the sinners. People who thought that ministers should stay away from politics. And yet you persevered. Later, you were ridiculed and called an Uncle Tom by many of the advocates of what was called the Black Power Movement, advocates of violence who rejected and disrespected you as a has-been. That hurt you. Recognition from the White House and even receiving a Nobel Peace Prize never overcame the feelings of hurt you felt from rejection from those in your own community. Your final week was not a good one, and was a manifestation of this phenomenon that was widespread. Your last march in Memphis in support of garbage workers went out of control. Young blacks broke away from the march and started breaking storefront windows in direct defiance of your wishes regarding nonviolence. They were making a point. Against your desires, you were whisked away from the march for your own safety. You are depressed. You left Memphis. When you returned to Atlanta, you uncharacteristically lashed out at those closest to you. You blamed them for what had happened in Memphis and accused them of not supporting you. But they knew that you were not angry. You were afraid. You were afraid that the nonviolent civil rights movement, as you knew it, as you birthed it, was dying. You returned to Memphis because you knew you had to. It was not something you wanted to do. You knew that Jesus had warned us that following him would result in being rejected and persecuted. Jesus warned us that following him would lead us to being hated and rejected and mistreated. You said that very often, but it sounded very much as though you were trying to convince yourself and not others. And while you understood it logically, you never seemed able to internalize it to the point that you were comfortable with it. It was not your plan to preach that night you returned to Memphis. You did not even intend to attend that meeting at the church that night. When the others left the Lorraine Hotel that night to go to the church, you did not even go. You only went based on a call from Reverend Abernathy at the church appealing for you to come. And when you went that night, you talked extemporaneously about the mountaintop and about the promised land. I'm going to close this letter with a brief assessment of the success of the movement that you led. As a way of illustrating the change that has taken place since the Birmingham campaign in 1963, I want to share with you an example from my church, the Episcopal Church. I mentioned earlier the letter of opposition to the Birmingham campaign penned by 8 Alabama clergymen. 2 of the 8 clergymen were bishops of the Episcopal Church. These 2 Episcopal bishops joined in telling Birmingham's black citizens to be patient and ignore your efforts to pursue justice. Well, today, the presiding bishop, that is the head bishop of the Episcopal Church, is a black man. And he ain't no regular black man. Bishop Curry believes in and espouses the concept of radical and universal love. He believes deeply in justice and the righteous treatment of all God's children. He advocates a theology of action. He is leading the Episcopal Church down the path that you created, and he is embraced by his people. That is how far the Episcopal Church has come in the last 60 years, from two bishops opposing the march towards freedom to a presiding bishop that champions the cause of justice and freedom. Like the Episcopal Church specifically, Doc, the American society generally has changed. And it has changed radically since Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of that bus in Montgomery. A black family can travel from the northern tip of Maine to the southern tip of Florida and not be concerned about public accommodations or facilities. Gone are the signs indicating which water fountains are reserved for white people. Gone are the signs stipulating where on a bus or what car on a train a black person can sit. There have been black men and women working in the White House. It's something other than butlers or maids. In fact, we have had a black first family, and they were catapulted to the White House by one of the whitest states in the Union. Yes, there has been change. The tremendous change for all of us can be traced back to Montgomery and Birmingham. All of it can be traced back to the blood that was shed on the streets of Birmingham in 1963. All the change can be traced back to the movement, the Christian movement, that you created and led. In Memphis, Tennessee, in 1968, you told us that we will go to the Promised Land. Today, I can say with confidence that I think we will. I won't get there, but we as a people will. We still have a long way to go, and there remain some difficult days ahead. But if we continue on the course that you pioneered, I can say with certainty that we as a people will get to the Promised Land. With gratitude, reverence, and sincerity, your devoted disciple, Fred Cleveland Faulkner, Jr.